I'm Amy Walter. Welcome to The Odd Years. On the last Odd Years, and if you didn't listen, go check it out, I talked with two Colby College professors, Nick Jacobs and Dan Shea, about rural voters and why rural Americans are overwhelmingly supporting Trump and Republicans across the board. On today's show, I'm turning from the urban-rural divide to a different one, the divide between Americans with college degrees and those without. I had the chance to review a book earlier this year that's coming out in the fall called Polarized by Degrees. The authors, political science professors Matt Grossman from Michigan State University and Dave Hopkins from Boston College. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, you've probably already heard of the so-called education divide in American politics. Those with college degrees increasingly support Democrats and liberal causes. Those without college degrees, well, they're more Republican and conservative. Matt and Dave explore not just how this divide came to be and how it impacts voting behavior, but they also explore what the degree gap says about which political party has power in the American culture, in corporate boardrooms, on college campuses, and in the media. And on that front, they say the left is winning, hands down. When I was reviewing this book, I knew I wanted to have Matt and Dave on the podcast, and they kindly agreed to come on even before the book is officially out. So here's our conversation, and please go pre-order the book. Dave Hopkins, Matt Grossman, thank you so much for joining us on The Odd Years.
Thanks so much for having us, Amy.
Hi, Amy. Good to be with you.
This is such a fantastic book you all wrote. It is not your first co-writing experience. You wrote Asymmetric Politics together back in 2016. Talk to us about how that experience, what you wrote about in that book, may have influenced the way you come to look at the issues you address in Polarized by Degree.
Asymmetric Politics came out a couple months before the 2016 election. So ever since it came out, people have been asking us about, is this still true? How much of the parties have been changing over time? And we have long agreed that there are big, momentous changes happening in the parties. We just don't necessarily see the same changes that others see. So we wanted to put the changes that we do see front and center. And so it was a pleasure to come back together.
Dave, you guys talk in the introduction about how this book was really personal to both of you, talking specifically about your hometowns or the areas you grew up in, watching the political affiliations change over the course of your growing up or maybe into your young adulthood. As well as the fact that you all are now part of an education, you work in education, and the role that education plays now as sort of the defining part of our culture wars, that its role in that has been so significant. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
You know, Matt and I are, well, we're old enough to remember the 1980s and 90s, when in a lot of ways, American politics was very different and American society was very different.
Yeah.
And one of the ways it was different was in those days, you know, if you were on the left in America, you kind of felt like you were fighting against authority figures, that sort of authority figures were conservative. And if you were a kind of a rebellious individualist, you were fighting against sort of, you know, the man who was sort of like on the right side of the spectrum. And if you were conservative in those days, you often felt like you were defending traditional institutions and social relations against this sort of new radical leftist rebellion.
Yeah.
And part of what inspired us to write the book was that we ourselves kind of in our own personal experiences have lived through a real evolution to the point that now it's more likely that it's people on the left side of the spectrum who say, let's all listen to the authority figures. They know what's best for everyone. And it's the people on the right side who are saying, hell no, you can't tell us what to do. And so that's part of why this book is in some ways a personal book for us. It's an account of our own experiences. And as you say, as educators, we ourselves now find our profession drawn into politics in a way that did not used to be the case. Now we see politicians on one side of the aisle hold up people with graduate degrees and credentialed expertise as the people who should be leading us and setting the rules for society and for government. And then we also see, of course, on the other side of the aisle, a lot of people saying professors and educators and teachers are the enemy and they are ruining the country and they are brainwashing the youth. And we need to do something about that. We need to cut budgets of universities, and we need to regulate even the things that professors say and teach in their research and in their classrooms.
Right. Matt, talk about how this came to be, that it's education level, not income level, that is really a stand-in or defining for your political affiliation.
Well, first, there's just been an increase in the number of people who have college educations and who have advanced degrees, and it has been increasing for a long time, but it took a while to get even close to a dominant electoral constituency in either political party, although educated people made their way into institutions, including political institutions, at very high levels at a much earlier time. It just was not seen as a likely constituency for either major party until quite recently. We also are very conscious that this is an international phenomenon. Right. Across rich democracies, the cultural dimensions, social issue dimensions have been replacing or at least coming to match economic dimensions in dividing parties across the world. And that coincides with an international increase in college educational attainment, with college-educated voters everywhere more socially, culturally liberal than people without college degrees. But what's unique about the United States is that we have such a dominant two-party system that the increasing educated voters that might appear as like a Green Party or a Liberal Party elsewhere have nowhere to go but the Democratic Party in the United States. And the people who oppose the increasing cultural liberalism of society have nowhere to go. They don't have an anti-immigration third party to go to. They have to take place within the Republican Party. So it's the same forces that are affecting political systems all over the world. But in the U.S., it takes this particular form because it has to essentially take over the two major political parties.
Well, and you all both write about the fact that while I think many of us, especially in political media, would point to the rise of Donald Trump as the catalyst for this change, the polarizing by degrees, if you will. This has actually been going on for some time. This isn't a brand new phenomenon. Dave, can you address that?
Sure. The role of Trump in all of this is, of course, very obvious. But we treat Trump not just as a cause, but also a consequence of these larger historical and global trends that we really think are reshaping politics. And so even if you are just looking at the relationship of educational attainment to partisanship, that starts to change well before Trump himself jumps into electoral politics in 2015. It gets faster once he's there. You know, he certainly is an accelerant of a lot of these trends, both in attracting populist, traditionalist, whites without college degrees into the Republican Party, but also repelling people who are more highly educated out of the Republican Party. There's no doubt that he's a major figure here, but Trump's own rise is in many ways, I think, in our view, a response by the Republican primary voters who selected him to be the leader of the Republican Party to these existing already in motion trends. And in particular, this belief that the country is changing, that it is becoming not only more racially diverse, but also more technocratic, where people with educational advantages are getting more power and influence over society and social institutions. And so Trump becomes this sort of, you know, sort of last resort of the politics in its normal form isn't working for people who are alienated by these trends. And so it's time to shake things up and choose someone who's going to, you know, try to sort of come in and reverse some of these trends. And so for us also, when we look around the world, as Matt said, and say, look, there are these very similar things happening in other countries, it becomes less an accidental story about, well, we have this sort of weird nomination system in America, and Trump just sort of like fortuitously happened to be the guy who navigated it in 2016. It becomes more, well, gee, this is a larger set of trends and developments that are happening all over the world. We're seeing this rise of conservative populism all over the world. And we want to explain not just what its effects are on our politics, but really what are its roots and why shouldn't we have been so surprised maybe that sooner or later this kind of thing was going to happen here in the United States.
Well, you both have pointed to the issue of white voters without college education. So we do have to talk about race in this and whether this polarization that we're seeing by degree is also showing up among voters of color. And of course, this is going to be a big focus of the 2024 campaign, right? Because you've got a lot of folks who've been writing now for a few years that there is the potential for a multiracial populist coalition on the right, not just a white populist coalition.
Well, certainly the divides based on college educational attainment among voters are much stronger among white voters than non-white voters across different racial categories right now. But part of the roots that we are tracing is that, you know, it had to start from a certain level that was the reverse of the current pattern. So, you know, college educated voters used to be more Republican for a very long period. So before you got the reversal, you had to have just the decline in that mattering a lot among white voters. And if you look over the long term, to the extent that we have data, that reversal was also there for minority voters. It just started much later. So we don't have the current gap, but if you had to predict the trend, you probably would assume some continuation of that. Now, that doesn't mean that we are predicting or we know there's going to be a big racial gap based on educational credentials among non-white voters. But some of the precursors are there. So, for example, minority voters also split on cultural issues based on their educational attainment levels. There are also plenty of minority voters that are culturally conservative and yet have been voting Democratic and viewing themselves as attached to the Democratic Party in the same way that we had culturally conservative white voters that were for a long time still attached to the Democratic Party, but those attachments drifted away. So I think looked at over the longer term, you would say we don't have a big gap right now, but certainly there are some precursors to expect that one might break out. And of course, for electoral politics, that is extremely important because if minority voters start to divide based on their views on cultural issues or their educational attainment level, that is all going to be bad for the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party relies on such high levels of support from Black, Hispanic, and other racial minority voters.
Right. So how much of this, I mean, this is sort of a chicken and an egg question, but how much of it is that educational attainment impact on your views of cultural and social issues, right? Which comes first, that you're socially conservative and that defines you regardless of what your education level is, or if you get a college degree, the likelihood is your cultural and social views are going to reflect that dominant strain within education, which is more culturally, socially liberal.
We think both are certainly operative, and there is causal evidence from elsewhere in the world that educational attainment does directly change people's social and cultural attitudes. But at the same,
so it's true, you guys are affecting all the legions of young people. You're poisoning them.
But at the same time, number one, to the extent that they have effects, they're usually found in peer groups, not from professors top down. And the changes in the political coalitions are much bigger than you would expect from just that effect alone. So in 2016, for example, a whole bunch of people changed their voting patterns based on college educational attainment, not just because they had just come out of college, but because they were enmeshed in different social networks, had different experiences. And we also point to the geographic patterns where they are even stronger. So you are affected not only by your college education level personally, but on whether you are surrounded by college educated voters or not. So all of those patterns, I think, make this self-reinforcing.
This is the other fascinating piece, I think, of your book. Is that what you really get at is the degree to which, while college graduates, the number of college graduates in this country definitely has increased, they're still a minority of the overall population, but they have an outsized influence on basically every one of our institutions, whether that's cultural or social or economic or, in your case, academic. Can you guys talk about that and that being really the driver in many ways of this? I don't know if we're going to call it a backlash or just a realignment to the authority and to institutionalism and expertise.
Sure. You know, this is not just a book about elections and election results.
Right.
And, you know, in the electorate, people with college degrees, as you point out, Amy, are still a minority and they don't get their way all the time. They certainly didn't like it when Trump got elected, but there was only so much they could do about it. But when you look beyond elections and you look at other major social institutions that have a lot of cultural influence in our society today, whether we're talking about the educational system or the news media, or we're talking about nonprofit organizations, the corporate sector, the tech industry, well, anytime you sort of look over at those sort of centers of social influence, you find that they are dominated and increasingly dominated by people with college degrees and often people with graduate degrees.
Right.
And so anytime we have a moment in history where those kinds of people have a distinct sensibility and a distinct set of political views or priorities, the institutions in which those people are embedded and the institutions which they lead are going to take on those sensibilities. And that to us is a major story of the last generation of two of not just American politics, but American society. And we can see it certainly in terms of cultural progressivism. We can see it in terms of schools and libraries and media companies and tech companies, for example, endorsing gay rights, endorsing Black Lives Matter, endorsing women's rights, even though in the mass public, those are still somewhat controversial topics. But the other place we can see this is in sort of this ideal model of governance. Who should be in charge of making decisions and how should policy be made? And increasingly, we're living in a complicated and even more complicated everyday world where people who have educational credentials, people who have claims to expertise, people who specialize intellectually in particular fields are gaining more and more social influence. And our society is sort of giving more power and more of a role to people like that. And, you know, we talk about in the book how, for example, George Meany, who was, you know, the head of the American labor movement, who is the head of the AFL-CIO for over two decades between 1955 and the late 1970s, he was a high school dropout, you know, and that was those were the days when you you could be a high school dropout, you could go into a trade and you could join a union and you could rise in the union and you could rise all the way to the top of the labor movement in this country that way. Well, if you look at Liz Schuller, who's today's AFL-CIO, she never worked as a plumber's assistant like George Meany did. She she went to college and she got a degree in journalism and she became a professional administrator and lobbyist. And that's how she became, you know, sort of worked her way up from there.
That's right.
Those sorts of stories are now ubiquitous across, you know, all walks of American industry, American institutions, and in fact, in much of the Western world. And so when people without college degrees sort of feel alienated and aggrieved, and they say this is a world where people like us are increasingly socially, vulnerable, where we don't have the same opportunities to rise to positions of influence as we did in the past, they're not wrong about that. That is a true thing that has happened. And in many ways, we could say, well, this is a good story. This is a story about more people getting education and us turning, you know, power and influence society over to the people who are the best intellectually equipped to make the right decisions. But even all of this is true, we shouldn't be surprised that people who don't have those advantages and don't have those opportunities feel like they're losing out and feel like they're threatened by the trends that are around us.
That is such an important point. And even you think about all the stories of the kid who worked his way up from the mailroom, right, to be the CEO of a company, or the journalists who, you know, they didn't graduate from college, but they knew their communities really, really well. They covered City Hall, and then one day they became the premier political reporter, right? Not because they went to Harvard, but because they understood the communities in which they lived and what they were covering. Again, another chicken and egg question for you too, which is, how much does this backlash against the sort of authority and expertise align with the rise in the internet and Google and YouTube? I'll just say, as a parent, the number of times I have to ask my teenager about where he got some idea or theory, it's usually from YouTube. And you can now be an influencer, have much more power in some ways than anyone with a college degree if you have a great YouTube following or TikTok following. So how do those two things kind of align, come together? Where do they go?
Well, I do think that we have had a major effect on our politics from the fragmentation of media. And yeah, of course, social media and the internet are part of that. And we certainly see with conservative populism that the points of view that conservative populists tend to have are not always very well represented in the mainstream media. And even when the New York Times hires conservative columnists, they don't hire pro-Trump conservative columnists. And so I do think that part of the story of how populist ideas spread around the existing mainstream media and through other channels is a story that has the internet as part of its part of the story there.
Right.
I don't think it's an accident. I also think, though, that we can see a major change on the left that in part is driven by social media. One of the things we talk a lot about in the book is how ideas and terminology that have been initiated by academics and activists have spread very quickly throughout society and social institutions dominated by progressives. And so if you're using words like structural racism or transphobia or BIPOC or Latinx or any of those sorts of neologisms, you probably pick those up online or from someone who picked them up online. And these the ideas behind them, the idea about structural racism and the patriarchy and all these sorts of ways of thinking and talking that are now familiar to us in politics, those are the words of and the sort of the language of the well-educated progressive. And the well-educated progressive has both absorbed and promoted those words and the ideas behind them And social media networks are a big part of that story as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we academics are hooked in with journalists and activists and other academics on social media much more, obviously, than we were in the past. And that has been a vehicle for the transmission of new ideas, new language, and new ways of thinking about politics. And of course, one of the dilemmas that the Democrats have now as a party coalition is that they are now sort of a coalition not only of the very online, very intellectual, very culturally progressive, highly educated left, but also the more working class, non-white population as well. And sometimes these two groups don't speak the same language and don't see the world the same way. And that's why the sort of social justice-centered progressive activism that we've seen over the past 10 years has not resulted in the actual voting strength of the Democratic Party rising among minority voters with less college education. Mm. But that's definitely part of the trends that we identify as important in American politics these days.
And the right sometimes tells this story as if it is a kind of a planned project by leftists over decades to take over these institutions. And our view is that they are definitely not wrong about the dominance of cultural progressivism in these institutions. Institutions like universities, the media, even corporate America, are increasingly dominated by these people and these ideas. But to us, it is just a much more a product of these ideas and views are overwhelming within educated constituencies. And so if you have institutions that are dominated by well-educated people, they are going to reflect those ideas. But I think even the story that the right is telling now is a sign that, you know, they're now telling the story of there's a hegemonic discourse that everybody has to abide by. That is very different than the story that they used to tell, which is that there was a threat to American institutions and culture from these odd lefties. Now they are sort of conceding that they've lost this long-term culture war battle about their views in these institutions.
Quick break. We'll be back with Matt Grossman and Dave Hopkins. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report team. It's our way of sharing the questions we love to ask and the conversations we enjoy having behind the scenes. If you'd like to explore more of what we have to offer, consider subscribing at cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Odd Year listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers.
There's another uncomfortable alliance I see on the right between this rise of populism and skepticism of experts and elites, and a corporate America that does still really attach itself to the Republican Party, at least in terms of its economic interests. It still sees the Republican Party, whether it's on taxes or regulation. And of course, we're seeing now many of the corporate leaders who during the Trump era came out and criticized him or said, you know, I don't think I can support him ever again, are now like, maybe it wasn't so bad. Maybe I think I'm changing my mind. What is that about? And how tenuous is that relationship between this rising populist, non-college base and a corporate sort of identity, which really does rely on the core Republican values of less taxes, lower regulation?
Well, the Republican Party has long faced disjunctures between its popular base and its organizational elites. We actually point out that the voting constituency of the Republican Party has always been dominated by non-college white voters. Mm-hmm. It's actually the Democrats' voting constituency that has changed dramatically from incorporating some of those to now being dominated by a coalition of racial minorities and white college educated voters, whereas the Republican constituency has remained about the same. And on economic policy, it has always been the case that there's an elite level Republican agenda that, although, you know, Republican voters share in very broad terms skepticism of government, they don't necessarily share in specific terms. When it comes to the education credentials, there is a marked oddity where you have some of the people who are complaining the most about educational institutions, people who graduated from Harvard and Yale and come from very credentialed places. But that is a long-term pattern. It's always been the case that the Republicans have tried to run against these institutions in part as people who went through them. It's just that it took a very long time for that skepticism to be translated to the Republican base. But now we do. We have a Republican base that's skeptical of universities, that's skeptical of the media, that's even skeptical of parts of corporate America. And so, you know, we have a disjuncture that's been there a long time, but it's now one that is reflected in Republicans' popular base.
And the, you know, the rise of the culture war has put these corporations in a very awkward position because they, on the one hand, continue to agree with the Republican Party by and large on economic policy and rely on Republicans to fight for lower taxes and deregulation and limiting union power and all those sorts of tried and true conservative economic, you know, objectives. But they also, corporations want to appeal to the sensibilities of younger and more educated people.
Including their employees.
Right. Certainly their customers, many of their customers, right? The young and the affluent are the customers you most want to hook in. But it's not even just from outside, it's also from within, that there are internal constituencies of employees, executives, managers, people in corporate legal departments and public relations departments and compliance departments and human resources departments who both want the public face of the company to be progressive on environmental issues or racial issues or gender issues or LGBT issues, but they also want the internal operations of the company to be sensitive to diversity and environmental responsibility and protection of women and minority employees. And so these companies get sort of caught in a bind. I mean, Walt Disney is probably the classic example of this, and we sort of tell that story in the book of where when the so-called Don't Say Gay bill gets passed in Florida, you know, Disney originally doesn't want to get involved in that fight. They want to stay out of it because they don't want to alienate Ron DeSantis and the other Republican politicians in Florida who are looking out for their economic interests, allowing them to govern Walt Disney World however they want. But there's so much pressure internally on the leadership of Disney to take a public stand against this bill and to join the chorus of other corporate leaders who are opposing this bill, that ultimately Disney capitulates. But of course, then they do face the backlash. They do get, sort of the retribution from Ron DeSantis and the Florida state government once they take that position. So it's not so much that corporate America is like no longer aligned with Republicans or no longer has friends in the Republican Party, but there is this tension that our new cultural politics introduces into the relationship. And the tech industry, of course, is another good example of that, where this is obviously a very successful industry economically. It's a very important industry. It's also an industry that's dominated by people who aren't that you know, aren't that sympathetic to conservative populism? They're a bunch of very well-educated, diverse young people who live in, you know, the Bay Area and Seattle and places like that. And of course, the tech world is getting more and more power, including over the way Americans communicate with each other. And so conservatives are, for understandable reasons, pretty suspicious of whether the tech industry can be counted on to be fair in how it regulates communication and social media and all of that. So it's not so much that corporate America is no longer still aligned, much of it aligned with the Republicans, but there's more to disagree about. And certainly specific companies and specific industries have become targets, not only rhetorical targets, but sometimes even legislative targets of Republican politicians in a way that we didn't see much of, you know, 40 or 50 years ago.
And there are places where the alignment should be easier. We talk about public health and COVID and environmental policy, especially climate, where you might expect, okay, you have a corporate interest, which don't want regulation, and they are more easily aligned with an anti-expert, anti-elite, anti-regulation consensus that is now more dominant among Republican activists and the Republican base as well. But one reason why we don't necessarily buy an argument that some make that this is all kind of a corporate conspiracy to bring along the rubes on behalf of tax cuts is that even in those cases, you sometimes have corporations kind of moving to reconcile themselves with the regulatory state, changing what they're doing to kind of go alongside the likelihood of increased regulation. And yet the Republican Party still kind of maintains that strong resistance on behalf of both its anti-expert consensus and against economic regulation.
Yeah. Let's just bring this back for a minute to 2024 and talk about how you think this divide is going to play out in the election. And one thing I'd love to get your opinion on is this increasing focus on the fact that those who are the most engaged, those who show up and vote in election after election, also happen to be, not surprisingly, more college educated. And those voters are supporting Biden by a stronger margin. And if you include just those voters, just those high propensity voters into your election models, Joe Biden basically wins by the same percentage that he did in 2020. But the more you move out into the audience of people who maybe they didn't vote in every election, maybe they voted in one of the last three, they're more likely to be people without a college degree, and those people are more likely to be supportive of Donald Trump. So curious your take on that phenomenon. Maybe it just lines up with, it lines up, it seems to me, with a lot of what you guys already wrote in Polarizing. But anything else about 2024 and this divide that you think is going to be important for us to pay attention to?
Sure. So absolutely, this is an important outcome of this change in the voting coalitions, that Democrats who used to be sure that they would benefit from higher electoral participation have now started to benefit from low turnout elections where the most high propensity voters are the most educated voters. And therefore, they do the best in those elections where some of the fewest voters turn out. So that's absolutely an important outcome of the election. Another trend that I would just watch is that what we have seen is that some trends that start first in the presidential election then start to move to the party as a whole. So political scientists are used to thinking that partisanship comes first, it's the hardest, and then comes voting behavior. But actually, the changes in the party coalitions have often come first in the presidential election and then filtered down to other elections and eventually to partisanship. So, for example, in 2016, we saw non-college white voters move more strongly to Donald Trump. But then in subsequent elections, we saw some of those trends actually materialize further in the other parts of the electorate. So I would watch the same things when it comes to changes, for example, in racial minority voters and changing alignments among young voters in age, voting by age. There are signs that some of the unique things about the presidential race this year so far are not filtering down to other elections or to voters' partisanship. But that doesn't mean they never will. It very much could be that trends that started the presidential race will make their way into dividing the parties more broadly.
Dave, what about you? What do you think we should be watching for?
Well, one of the things I think is important this year is looking at the Biden campaign and sort of the Biden campaign's strategy for trying to win a second term. You know, Biden, originally there was a sort of a premise to nominating Biden and electing Biden in 2020 is that he was going to reverse some of these trends.
Right.
That he was a guy who could win back the white working class to the Democratic Party. And this wasn't a crazy idea. I mean, there were ways, certainly superficially, that his own background and style and personal, long personal history in politics, he really is a sort of a walking bridge to a bygone era of the Democratic Party. But in 2020, it turned out, you know, when all the votes were in, that really he won more because he continued to achieve additional gains for the Democratic Party among the college educated. There wasn't a mass swing back to the Democrats when they nominated Biden among the white non-college vote. But of course, in this particular election, Biden in some ways is caught between a more progressive, younger, college-educated sector of his party who wants him to continue to move left on cultural issues and wants him to take a stand, you know, for Palestinian rights and wants him to, you know, endorse in emerging progressive causes, and is credibly can threaten not really to be that enthusiastic about supporting him if he doesn't do those things. On the other hand, Biden certainly doesn't want to suffer even more desertions from older, less educated, whiter, more moderate right. voters. Especially in the states he needs to win in the Electoral College, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, et cetera. So I think that, of course, you know, politicians are often caught between, you know, between a base and a swing vote, and there's nothing necessarily new about that. But I think in Biden's case, given his vulnerability in the polls and the way the Electoral College is sort of stacked in this election, I think the strategic maneuvering that he and his campaign does to try to split the difference on being pulled in these two different directions and their ultimate success in doing that will end up being one of the main stories of this election. We more or less know, you know, what we're going to get out of Trump and what Trump's sort of strategy is. How Biden is going to make the case for a second term, I think is still a fascinating question.
Yeah, and the Biden campaign has, you know, tried to be much closer to union leaders, to tout its achievements in the auto industry as the Obama administration did as well. I think the Biden administration points to how some of these processes are self-reinforcing, even if, you know, the electoral strategy might suggest something else. You know, the Biden administration's major policy achievements are in climate policy, student loans. They are things that are responsive to the changes in the Democrats' constituency. And they will tell you that some of the infrastructure investments are targeted at non-college constituencies, but it is difficult for any particular campaign to be making these arguments if the image of the party is changing over time. Mm-hmm. And the image of the Democratic Party is very much tied to their college-educated voters and the priorities of their college-educated voters, regardless of what any one campaign, you know, might want to change.
Right. So even the person who comes from that background doesn't get the benefit of the doubt that they once would. Let's end with one sort of fun question. As you guys have both noted, you are children of the 1980s, great era. By the way, we're taping this on June 5th, which is the same date that Ferris Bueller took his day off in 1985. Really, truly one of the best films of the 1980s, if you ask me. So when you think about a cultural phenomenon that you grew up with, which was your favorite?
Well, we should tell people that the book has lots of cultural references. Most of them were put there by Dave. And I think one of the most interesting is, you know, Dave's, you know, very strong familiarity with The Simpsons and changes in The Simpsons over time. So maybe it'd be worth telling that.
Oh,
story.
That's perfect.
Yeah. Well, people who are younger us may be surprised to know that when the Fox network first went on the scene, it was decried by conservatives for basically being overly culturally subversive. Yep. And undermining family values by giving us shows like The Simpsons and Married with Children, and that most of the sitcoms that I grew up watching as a kid were ones that were extremely earnest and told us to say no to drugs constantly, and were very conventional and conservative. And Fox sort of came on the scene with In Living Color and The Simpsons and all of that. And it was seen as a real threat to the prevailing cultural mores of the Reagan era. And Rupert Murdoch was part of the problem. and so people may not know that. But The Simpsons was targeted by George Bush Sr. and Barbara, criticized by name for providing poor role models for the nation's youth. And one of the ways that we've talked about in the book, how cultural controversies have evolved, is that nowadays when you hear criticism about a book or a TV show that's political criticism, it's less likely to be from sort of family values conservatives saying that they're undermining, you know, the sanctity of marriage or whatever. And it's more likely to be from people on the left who say it's problematic. And The Simpsons have lasted so long so that they became problematic, and with the character of Apu, for example, being newly judged in the 2020s as being racially insensitive.
Right.
So, the politics of America we've seen over the past 30 years or so, both parties have sort of been about equally successful. And the control of the government has sort of gone back and forth, and we've had lots of very close elections, and both sides have had lots of wins and lots of losses. But the story we tell about the larger direction of American society and culture in this book is that the left has mostly won. And certainly if you take the 80s as a starting point, which we do in many ways, compared to the 80s, American culture and American society today is much more dominated by progressive values, mm-hmm. and ideas, mm-hmm. than it was at that time. In that time, and we understand that many of the people who read our book and many of our colleagues are not necessarily sympathetic to conservative populism and to conservatism as a political cause. And they may not share conservatives' normative judgments about these things, but I think when conservatives complain or critique or just observe that in many ways the country is moving left, we think they're actually right about that. We think they're objectively onto something. We have lots of evidence in the book to sort of show that that is true. And there's no way in our view to understand the rise of conservative populism and the backlash to progressive technocracy without understanding that it is built on some really true changes, perceptions among certain subgroups of Americans that they are that they're losing ground, that they're losing ground, not just economic ground, but losing cultural importance and relevance. And so that's part of the story we tell in the book and pop culture, which political scientists often sort of, you know, ignore or look down their nose at or don't think is important or relevant. We actually think it's really important and really relevant.
Absolutely.
And really helps understand larger changes in American society. And so we think that's part of the story, and we hope that other scholars and other analysts who come after us looking at these questions also turn their gaze not just to the results of elections and the, you know, the operation of Congress and those sorts of things that we often study as political scientists, but also look wider at major social trends and the context, the social context in which our politics is sort of operated.
Absolutely. And politics being downstream of culture as a big piece of that. And nothing will be better than a great Simpsons reference, I always say. Matt, Dave, thank you again for coming and speaking with me. Thank you for your book. I really do think it was really insightful. And for those of you who think, oh, I'm not really that academic, just I thought what was wonderful about it is you write for normal people.
Well, thanks so much, Amy. Really appreciate your support of the book, and you're very kind to have us on. And we had a great time talking with you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. If you want more podcasts from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber, which gives you access to our new podcast, The Editor's Roundtable. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman. Thank you, and I'll talk to you soon.